60 Minutes, coming up next.
Why are razors so expensive? Well, maybe because big shave companies force you to buy razors with shave tech that you don't actually need, like a vibrating handle, a back scratcher, and a laser pointer. It's time to stop the madness and join DollarShaveClub.com. DollarShaveClub.com sends top quality razors and grooming supplies right to your door for a couple of bucks a month. So there's no more overpaying for razors and no more squeezing shaves out of a dull blade. It's time to upgrade to the smarter way to shave at DollarShaveClub.com/60 minutes. That's DollarShaveClub.com/60 minutes.
Three years after the disaster at Fukushima in Japan, you can still see the impact in the towns that neighbor the power plant because they're empty. We were allowed to go to the town of Tomioka recently, but the loudspeakers warned visitors they should leave. The disaster seems to have stopped time. The clock shows 2:46, the moment the earthquake hit. And the damage to shops and homes looks like it could have happened yesterday.
There's been a lot of debate about Obamacare and whether it's possible for the government to cover every American. 7 million have signed up for it so far, but we found out that almost as many may never get on board.
Y'all come on in out of the rain.
Hello, Mr. Hank. How are you doing?
For a fortunate few, there is the health wagon.
Hold your breath for me.
Who are these people who come into the van?
They are people that are in desperate need. They have no insurance, and they usually wait, we say, until they are train wrecks.
Hildebrand Gurlitt was one of Hitler's favorite art dealers. And as the Führer was accumulating power, he was accumulating thousands of artworks, many plundered from Jews and museums. When Gurlitt died, his reclusive son Cornelius inherited them.
Did you have any idea that he had so many paintings in that apartment?
I tell you what, nobody had any idea about this.
Masters like Matisse, Chagall, and Otto Dix, worth more than $1 billion today. So who do these masterpieces belong to now? That's our story tonight.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
The magnitude 9 earthquake that struck Japan on March 11, 2011, not only shook the ground, it shook the Japanese people's faith in their government and the nuclear power industry. You can see the impact of the disaster in the towns right around the plant. Only you can't get there. The earthquake did some damage, the tsunami did more, but the reason many of them are empty and off-limits today is because of the nuclear accident at the Fukushima power plant next door. The whole area is now a radioactive wasteland, and the people who live there don't know if they'll ever be able to go home. Many don't know if they'll want to. 3 years later, the events of March 11th darkened their lives so deeply that many speak of it simply as 3/11. The hell that broke loose on March 11, 2011 was the strongest earthquake in Japan's history. When the shaking stopped, the tsunami raced toward shore with as much fury as nature can muster. Almost all of the more than 18,000 people who died that day on Japan's northeast coast died in the flood. The quake didn't do much damage to the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power station, but the tsunami shut down the reactor's emergency cooling systems and they started to melt down. Hydrogen gases inside the buildings then exploded, spreading radiation into communities more than 25 miles away. Today, in the town of Tomioka, the radiation levels are considered safe enough to allow people in during the day. Loudspeakers warn visitors that they must leave by 3 p.m. We were alone on the day we were there. The disaster seems to have stopped time. The clock shows 2:46, the moment the earthquake hit, and the damage to shops and homes looks like it could have happened yesterday. The stack of newspapers we found were dated March 12, 2011, the day after the quake and tsunami. You can see people had to leave in a hurry. That was the morning. The government told people of this town and neighboring towns to get out quickly. Welcome to Okuma, says the sign. Population today, 3 years later, zero. More than 11,000 people left town that day and never returned.
Would you ever want to go back to Okuma to live there again?
Yes, I would like to before I die.
Norio Kimura lived with his wife and two daughters next door to his parents. The tsunami killed his father, his wife, and his youngest daughter, Yuna, a bright and cheerful seven-year-old. This is what their homes looked like before March 11, 2011. This is what's left today. Foundations and scraps of memories that he keeps in a small box by what was once the front door.
This is a shoe she was wearing that day, which was found in a heap of rubble 6 months after the disaster.
Because of radiation, Kimura can only visit his former home 10 times a year and stay only 5 hours. In February, his allotted day came in the middle of a blizzard. On each visit, Kimura brings flowers to a small shrine he built to honor his family. They were among the 111 people who died in Okuma that day. The remains of 110 have been recovered. The only one still missing is Norio Kimura's daughter, Yuna. 10 times a year, he goes back home to search for her.
On Saturday, you were digging again in Okuma. It was snowing. It was freezing. Why?
To find Yuna, of course. And also, if I stop searching or gathering her things, I will lose the connection with her. To be honest, the reason why I can live my life every day is because I have to find her and her things. I need to do this to keep my sanity.
Volunteers now help Kimura dig through the piles of debris left by the tsunami. Everyone's dressed in protective clothing to limit their exposure to radiation. The digging seems futile, but on this day, Kimura unearthed clothing he says belonged to his surviving daughter, Mayu. On March 11th, the day of the tsunami, Kimura made a mistake for which he will never forgive himself. He was at work on a farm, and he stayed there.
Did you think then that there would be a tsunami?
There was a radio at my work, and my boss told me that the tsunami was going to be 3 meters tall. My house is 5 to 6 meters above sea level, so I was convinced that our home would be fine and didn't worry about it after that at all.
Do you think there's anything you could have done to save your family?
I should have gone home right away. I regret believing the information easily while my family was in life-threatening danger. Even now I say to myself, what was I thinking?
When radiation forced the evacuation of Okuma, the town leader told Norio Kimura to stop searching for the missing and start caring for the living.
So he and his daughter moved here to the Japanese Alps, where the brisk air and the snow-capped mountains made radiation and tsunamis difficult to imagine.
Kimura has traded farming for a guest house he's planning to open. His daughter, Mayu, talks about her mother more than her missing sister, and doesn't ask why her father continues searching for her. Their new mountain home is 2,000 feet above the perils of the sea and 180 miles from the Fukushima plant. Ghost towns surround the plant now, but 3 years later, There are still more than 4,000 workers there, all of them wearing layers of protection. Because of the exposure to radiation, the men in this building are only allowed to work 2.5 hours a day. They're not producing any electricity. They're just cleaning up.
Were TEPCO workers adequately trained to handle the emergency?
I don't think so.
Within months of the accident, Yoichi Funabashi, a former newspaper editor, headed an investigation into what went wrong and why. It was the only investigation not sponsored by the government, and its conclusions were brutal.
I was very much concerned about the government not telling the truth to the public.
The revelations in Funabashi's report added to the public's anger and dismay. He wrote that from the beginning, the government had conspired with the industry to convince people that nuclear power is safe.
So the government effort at the time was to convince people that there was nothing to worry about.
Exactly. Nothing to worry about. Don't worry. Okay. Even don't prepare for that, severe accident. Okay, because that would cause that unnecessary unease and unnecessary misunderstanding.
And there's no reason to prepare.
No reason to prepare. So this avoidance ultimately translated into unpreparedness.
Mother Nature threw a real curveball to the Japanese with that huge tsunami.
Last year, TEPCO hired American nuclear engineer Lake Barrett as an advisor. Barrett directed the cleanup at the Three Mile Island nuclear plant after its accident in 1979.
It's estimated that the cleanup is going to take 30 to 40 years. To a layman, that sounds very, very long.
To me, that's not long at all. That's what I would expect for that kind of thing. It's a huge challenge. It's a big on-site mess that they have to clean up, and it's going to take them decades to do it. It took us 10 years to do Three Mile Island, and Three Mile Island accident was much simpler than they have at Fukushima.
Are they where you thought they would be 3 years later?
I'd hope they'd be further along. It's been challenging technically. It's been challenging culturally and politically for them. But they're making good progress now.
Sounds like you're being a little diplomatic.
Well, decision-making process in Japan is complicated.
Decision-making in Japan requires consensus, and reaching consensus often takes a very long time. The most difficult job will be to dismantle the melted reactors, but radiation is too high for workers to get there. For now, TEPCO is inundated with groundwater that leaks into the reactors and gets contaminated. Every day, 100,000 gallons of radioactive water has to be pumped out before it reaches the ocean. TEPCO is filling storage tanks almost as fast as it can build them, and they're notorious for leaking. Another enormous cleanup is happening outside the plant. Entire communities are being cleared of contaminated materials that will have to be stored for generations. This part of Japan is known for its agriculture, but the only crop growing now is the multitude of black bags holding the radioactive waste, filling the empty spaces in towns like Okuma. Now, some of the kids from Okuma live and go to schools 70 miles away.
How many of you would like to go back to Okuma? Everybody. How many of you think you will go back to Okuma? What's keeping you from going back to Okuma now? You can tell me.
Because there's a lot of radiation. There's a lot of radioactive material there.
These kids will be middle-aged before the cleanup is finished. Their homes could have been rebuilt quickly if it had just been an earthquake and a tsunami. It's the man-made disaster which will take decades to repair. This is the class that Norio Kimura's daughter Yuna would have been in if she were alive. Her friend Kureya remembers they ate lunch together.
Where is she now?
In Okuma. She's lonely, being alone in the town of Okuma all this time. I think she must be lonely.
About a third of the residents from Okuma decided to stick together and moved into what the government called temporary housing. Temporary is lasting a long time. The three generations of kibbutzes that once lived together are now split apart. Norio and his daughter live in Nagano, 5 hours away from his mother, Tomoe. She lives in the temporary housing, alone, in a cold and cramped room furnished with photographs. The Kimuras, like many Japanese, have a strong connection to their dead and feel obliged to help them be at peace. As long as the dead are in limbo, so are the living.
You've lost so much of your family. Why aren't you together with your son now?
I'm with my husband's ashes now. Once I find a proper place to put him, I'd like to go to Nagano.
What do you think the right place will be?
Our family cemetery in Okuma is contaminated with radiation now. I could come back 2 or 3 times a year to burn incense for him, but my grandchild would not be able to come. I don't want to keep him where his grandchild, whom he used to adore so much, can't even come to visit.
Ten times a year, Norio Kimura visits his ancestors in the family cemetery, a place where he thought he would be laid to rest one day, and where his children would come to visit him. But he won't find any peace, he says, until after he finds Yuna.
Do you think there's any chance you'll ever find your daughter?
I know that the chance is very slim. But no matter how slim the chance is, I still cannot stop. From the outside looking in, I know that this is very unlikely, but I still can't stop, even if I cannot ever find her.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
So I was recently looking to buy a new car, and I thought to myself, there has to be a better way. And that's when a friend of mine told me about this new way to buy a car. It's called TrueCar.com. At TrueCar.com, you can actually see what others paid for the car that you're looking at in your area, so you know if you're getting a good price. Because here's what happens. At TrueCar.com, you get a savings certificate, and you just take your savings certificate to a TrueCar certified dealer. You can't beat it. Save time, save money, never overpay. If you're going to buy a car, go to TrueCar.com today.
President Obama announced last week that more than 7 million people have signed up for Obamacare. But what went unsaid is that almost as many people have been left out. Millions of Americans can't afford the new health insurance exchanges. For the sake of those people, Obamacare told the states to expand Medicaid, the government insurance for the very poor. But 24 states declined. So, in those states, nearly 5 million people are falling into a gap. They make too much to qualify as destitute for Medicaid, but not enough to buy insurance. We met some of these people when we tagged along in a busted RV called the Health Wagon. Medical mercy for those left out of Obamacare. The tight folds of the Cumberland Mountains mark the point of western Virginia that splits Kentucky and Tennessee, the very center of Appalachia, a land rich in soft coal and hard times. Around Wise County, folks are welcomed by storefronts to remember what life was like before unemployment hit 9%.
The roads are narrow and windy curves, so it's not easy to drive the bus.
This is Teresa Gardner's territory. She can't be more than 5'4", but she muscles the bus through the hollers, deaf to the complaints of a 13-year-old Winnebago that's left its best miles behind it.
Having a problem seeing here.
You really can't see.
The wipers are nearly shot, and the defrosters out cold.
There you go. You can see a little better now.
Right.
I understand there's a hole in the floorboard here somewhere.
Yes, it's right over there, so don't get in that area.
The old truck may be a ruin, but like most RVs, it's pretty good at discovering America. Gardner and her partner, Paula Mead, are nurse practitioners aboard the Health Wagon, a charity that puts free health care on the road.
How many patients did we have on the schedule today?
He was going to see what he can free up for us.
The health wagon pulls up in parking lots across six counties in southwestern Virginia.
Y'all come on in out of the rain.
It's not long before the waiting room is packed.
Hello, Mr. Hank. How are you doing?
And two exam rooms are full.
Hold your breath for me.
With advanced degrees in nursing, Gardner and Mead are allowed to diagnose illnesses, write prescriptions, order tests, and x-rays. On average, there are 20 patients a day. That's recently up by 70%. The Health Wagon is a small operation that started back in 1980. It runs mostly on federal grants and corporate and private donations.
Blood pressure had been high before?
Just when I get aggravated.
Who are these people who come into the van?
They are people that are in desperate need. They have no insurance, and they usually wait, we say, until they are train wrecks. Their blood pressures come in emergency levels. We have blood sugars come in 500, 600 because they can't afford their insulin.
But why do they not see a doctor or a nurse before they become, as you call it, train wrecks?
Because they don't have any money. They don't have money to pay for labs. They don't have money to go to an ER. And these are very proud people. They, you know, you go to the ER, you get a $3,500 bill. And then what do? You're given a prescription. You can't fill it. That's why they're train wrecks. They have nowhere else to go.
Glenda Moore had nowhere to go but the ER when the pain in her leg became unbearable. Her job at McDonald's making biscuits didn't include insurance that she could afford.
The only doctor that would see me, you had to have $114 up front just to be seen.
What does $114 mean to your monthly budget?
Oh, my gosh. That's half of my weekly pay. I make $7.80 an hour. My paycheck was about, after taxes, about $475 every 2 weeks.
The pain was from a blood clot. She needed Lovenox, a clot buster, that costs about $500 for a full treatment.
Was she on Lovenox when she was discharged from the hospital?
Paula Mead got the call from the ER, which didn't want to bear the cost. The Health Wagon had the drug for free, and there was no charge for some stern medical advice.
You are going to die if you don't quit smoking.
Okay.
And it could be within a week. You need to stop now.
Okay.
Okay.
She took the advice to stop smoking and took Lovenox, but one day, she felt so bad she went back to the ER.
And they did a CAT scan and an x-ray and found the blood clot had went to my lung, but they also saw another mass on my lung and then transported me to a bigger hospital. They found the lesions in my brain. So I was diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer and brain cancer.
What are the doctors telling you?
I start my treatment on Monday, the brain radiation. And he seems he seemed optimistic.
Are you hopeful?
I am. I have been. I don't know. I feel very hopeful.
Hope, especially when the odds are long, has always been essential to survival in Appalachia. The recovery from the Great Recession hasn't arrived. In coal these days, they just take the top off the mountain, and you don't need many men for that. Around here, about 1,000 have been laid off in the last 2 years. 12% of the folks don't have enough to eat, and we met them waiting for their number at Zion Family Ministries Church, where a charity called Feeding America was handing out just enough to get through a week, if you stretch. 1,654 lined up, a parking lot of possibilities for Gardner, Mead, and the Health Wagon. They've known these people and each other most their lives.
You've been together since 8th grade?
Yes.
8th grade, yes.
Why do you do this work?
Because somebody has to. You know, there's people here. You know, we had dreams. We wanted to move away from here. We did. And then we come back and we saw the need. And actually, there's a vulnerable population here that's different from the rest of America. I mean, there are people, you can replicate this, but we're kind of forgotten. Mm-hmm. There's no one here to take care of them but us.
These patients would be taken care of in the 26 states that expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. The federal government pays the extra cost to the states for 3 years. But Virginia and the others that opted out fear that the cost in the future could bankrupt them. So Health Wagon patients we met have fallen through this unintended gap.
Do you have insurance?
No, ma'am.
No. Okay.
Have any of you tried to sign up for the president's health insurance plan?
No.
Why not?
I can't afford it.
I can't either.
Sissy Cantrell was laid off from a Head Start center. She's been suffering from migraines and seizures.
I cry for no reason at all.
Have you been seeing a counselor?
No.
Okay.
She came away from the health wagon with medication.
Okay.
Brittany Phipps works more than 50 hours a week, but that's two part-time jobs, so there's no insurance for her diabetes.
So you're getting your insulin through the health wagon?
I am now, yeah.
And if that wasn't available, where would you get the insulin?
I don't know.
Walter Laney's diabetes blinded him in one eye and threatens the other. The health wagon stabilized him and set him up with a specialist.
Hey, Walter, it's Dr. Isaacs. How's it going?
That's going pretty good.
How have your sugars been?
Okay.
They got my blood sugars back under control. Before this year, I was in the hospital 3-4 times, and this year I ain't been in none since I've been seeing them. If it hadn't been for them, I don't think I'd be here today.
Outside the church where they were handing out food, we met Dr. Joe Smitty, a lung specialist who's the health wagon's volunteer medical director.
This is a third world country of diabetes, hypertension, lung cancer, and COPD.
Dr. Smitty drives a second health wagon, a tractor trailer x-ray lab.
I guess they taught you something about radiology and all of that in medical school. Did they teach you how to drive an 18-wheeler?
I did have to go to tractor trailer school, and it took a long time.
Was that harder than medical school in some ways?
It was very difficult to get anyone to insure a doctor to drive a tractor trailer. Insurance companies didn't believe me.
Hold it.
His x-ray screen is a window on chronic, untreated disease, including black lung from the mines.
We've seen co-workers pneumoconiosis, emphysema, COPD, enlarged hearts. There's 15 of the 26 had significant abnormalities here today.
Just today?
Just today.
But when they leave your health wagon, they still don't have health insurance. How do they get treated for these things that you're finding?
We negotiate. We can talk to the hospital system. We don't leave any patient unattended. We raise money for them.
You find a way.
We will find a way.
They found a way to get Glenda Moore radiation for her brain cancer, but she'd been a smoker for 25 years, and she died 3 months after our interview.
You don't like this idea of receiving charity?
No. Oh, I hate it. My dad was in the military, and when he was diagnosed with cancer, he was taken care of. And I don't know, I just always assumed, you know, that's how it would work.
Do you think things would have been different if you'd had an opportunity to go to a doctor more often?
Oh, definitely. I know it would be different.
The outreach to all the people like Glenda Moore cost the health wagon about $1.5 million a year. A third of that is from those federal grants and the rest from donations. Doctors, volunteer, and pharmaceutical companies donate drugs. But when we were with them,
we got no electricity, like, on the house side.
They sure could have used a new truck battery.
There it goes.
Yay. Can we give you all a free flu shot while you're here for helping us?
Need a free flu shot, Beaver?
These are the ones I think we need to focus on.
Teresa Gardner and Paula Mead apply for grants and travel to churches, praying for donations and passing the plate.
Are there days you say to yourself, I can't do this anymore?
Oh, every day. Not every day. I shouldn't say every day. There are a lot of days that you go home, you're so frustrated because we're writing grants till 10 o'clock at night. We're begging for money, and you're almost in tears because we're like, okay, what are we going to do? Because I've got a family, too. And it gets frustrating. It gets hard.
It's enough to wear you out, Teresa.
We're pretty beat down by the end of the day on most days, but we do get more out of it than we ever give.
When you look at it practically, you think, what in the world am I thinking? But then I have that one patient that may come in and say, couldn't bring anything, not been able to pay anything. Here's a quilt I want to give you. And I mean, when they do that and they're so heartfelt and they put their arms around you, I don't know what I'd do without you.
So you're doing a lot better. Yeah,
it lets you think, okay, I was put here for a purpose.
And you can do it another day.
You're a blessing to us, so.
Well, thank you. Y'all are a blessing to us.
It's them, and that's what touches our heart.
This week in Virginia, there's a crisis at the Capitol, where the new Democratic governor is demanding Medicaid expansion from the Republican House. But neither side will budge, and now there's a threat of a government shutdown in that state. There's no shutting down the health wagon, though. Gardner and Meade have raised money for a new truck, and they hope to get it on the road in the spring.
60 Minutes, coming up after this short break.
Why are razors so expensive? Well, maybe because big shave companies force you to buy razors with shave tech that you don't actually need, like a vibrating handle, a back scratcher, and a laser pointer. It's time to stop the madness and join DollarShaveClub.com. DollarShaveClub.com sends top-quality razors and grooming supplies right to your door for a couple of bucks a month. So there's no more overpaying for razors and no more squeezing shaves out of a dull blade. It's time to upgrade to the smarter way to shave at DollarShaveClub.com/60Minutes. That's DollarShaveClub.com/60Minutes.
Two years ago, German authorities, conducting a routine tax investigation, stumbled on the largest trove of missing art since the end of World War II. The massive collection, barely a fraction of the hundreds of thousands of artworks still missing, was discovered in a Munich apartment owned by Cornelius Gerlet, the reclusive 81-year-old son of one of Hitler's favorite art dealers. Most of it was art plundered from museums and from Jewish collections. For Germans, it was an unwelcome reminder of a bitter history. To the heirs of the victims, it's perhaps a last chance to recover a small vestige of family history. The discovery also triggered a legal battle about who really owns that art. Did you have any idea that he had so many paintings in that apartment?
I tell you what, nobody had any idea about this. Really? How can you live with 1,400 paintings in a flat, in a 90 square meter flat? I thought maybe he has 100 or 150, but 1,000. Everybody was surprised, you know?
Eckhard Gerlet is Cornelius Gerlet's cousin, a rather flamboyant photographer now living in Barcelona.
His friends were his paintings, right? And for the last 60 years, he was living with his paintings. This was his idea of life, you know?
Of the 1,400...
1,406.
You got it right down to the last one.
I mean, it's different if you have 1,400 Picasso or you have 1,406.
Picasso was just the beginning. Cornelius Gerlet's secret hoard of art included modern masters like Matisse, Chagall, Franz Marc, and Otto Dix. Gerlet's small world fell apart in 2010 almost by accident. Traveling back from Switzerland to Germany, a customs inspection brought him under suspicion and triggered a tax investigation that would be his undoing.
They had caught him on a train with 9,000 euros in cash in his pocket, which made them suspicious. Then they tried to look him up in their files, and they couldn't find him. The man didn't seem to exist. He was not registered, he didn't pay taxes, he didn't receive any benefits, so the man was just not there.
Billy Corte is a lawyer who specializes in tracking down stolen art.
I can imagine the conclusions they drew when they saw this old man surrounded by hundreds and hundreds of works of art. There's something very fishy going on here. Maybe he's a secret art dealer. Maybe he's involved in some smuggling activities. There must be enormous amounts of money at stake.
It was on February 28, 2012, that agents from the German customs police raided a fifth-floor apartment in this nondescript building in Munich. It's fair to say they were blown away by what they found. 1,400 works of art, some of them worth millions. They also found 80-year-old Cornelius Gerlet, a virtual hermit, who said the only friends he had in this world were his art. Art thought to be worth over $1 billion, art piled on shelves, much of it art the Nazis declared to be degenerate. It was art taken from the walls of museums and from Jewish-owned galleries and collectors. All of it acquired by Hildebrand Gerlet, Cornelius's father. He was a leading art dealer chosen by Hitler to sell the art to customers abroad for hard currency. Much of it featured in a 1937 degenerate art show in which Hitler wanted to show Germans what he regarded as the decadence and depravity of modern avant-garde art. Art historian Vanessa Vogt A specialist in art of that era was called in by police during the raid.
I saw there Cornelius Gullit. He is a man who is ill. He was afraid, and he didn't speak.
Cornelius sat stunned as agents went through his apartment. Did he say anything to you or to the agents from the government?
No, he was really shocked of this situation. I think in this apartment there were no people for many, many years. I think there were perhaps an art dealer, but no one else.
Did he seem to be sane?
Yeah, he was.
His cousin says after Cornelius's father died, he never allowed anyone into the apartment or his crumbling house in Salzburg, Austria, where he kept a collection of 238 works of art of immense value, like this painting by Monet.
He gave him the whole collection of these paintings as an inheritance, right? To survive. So every time Cornelius ran out of money, he sold one of these paintings.
Almost overlooked among the cash was a small drawing of a piano player by the German romanticist Karl Spitzweg.
It's one of the...
It is a drawing Martha Henriksen has spent the better part of her life trying to track down. The Nazis had confiscated it from her grandfather, Henry Henriksen, along with his entire art collection. Before the Gullit collection was discovered, had you pretty much given up hope?
I was absolutely stunned. I wasn't expecting anything like that.
During the raid, agents found Gullit's father's records from 1940, which revealed details of a sale of four works once owned by her grandfather. The sale was really theft by other means. Henriksen never received the money. In 1942, he was gassed at Auschwitz.
Legally, it was a sale. Morally and ethically is another question, but...
It was a sale with the seller having no choice.
Exactly.
Another painting Gullit had was Two Riders on the Beach by Max Liebermann, now valued at more than $1 million.
They stopped us.
David Torin, now 88 and blind, left Germany on a Kinder transport days before the war began. He last saw the painting at his uncle's home in Breslau, just before his father was arrested by the Nazis. Both parents were murdered at Auschwitz.
There came two guys from the Gestapo. We have instructions to take you to Gestapo headquarters. That day, I remember every little detail. I was sitting in the anteroom at the Winter Garden and looked at the picture. And that was the last time I saw that picture.
Torin had been searching for any trace of his family's art collection, but all he found was a 1939 Nazi inventory that mentions the Liebermann painting.
The letter says that the action to confiscate art owned by Jews has been very successful, but there are still some rich Jews left. And the first example, he mentions my uncle. And the letter ends with, I warned the Jew David Friedman not to dispose of any of the art objects until we come back.
After the war, the Allies' Art Recovery Unit, the Monuments Men, found and returned millions of artworks. They also found Hildebrand Gullit hiding out in this Bavarian castle owned by a local Nazi party leader. Inside were hundreds of treasures Hildebrand and his young son Cornelius had hidden. Many more were apparently stashed in hiding places all over Germany. The Monuments Men took some of his paintings, but they let him keep most of his collection, did they not?
That's an unresolved mystery, I think, up to this day. He was able to produce one story after another about how he had acquired these before the war, and for reasons that I have a hard time understanding, is he got away with it.
Among the artworks in that castle was David Torin's uncle's painting. Hildebrand Gullit told the Monuments Men it was a gift from his parents before the war, and that painting, like most of the others, was returned to him. Did he feel any guilt working for the Nazis?
I'm sorry, but he had to survive. So what would you do? I mean, this is just a thing. What would you do?
But was he as innocent as he claimed?
Most of these artworks were stolen, I think. Yeah. Confiscated from Jewish families or stolen, yeah.
Hannes Hartung and Tito Park, two lawyers who've represented Cornelius Gurlitt, say the sins of the father should not be visited on the son.
Hildebrand Gurlitt was not completely innocent, that's for sure. Now there are cases. We will deal them in a fair manner. Because, you know, under German law, morality has nothing to say. I'm sorry to tell you that. The German law, it's a law which has not been made for the horrible outcome of the Third Reich and all that happened. So now what we are talking about now is about morality and how to deal with moral responsibility.
German law puts a 30-year statute of limitations on stolen property, so the works, by law, remain the property of Cornelius Gurlitt. As for the art itself, authorities won't explain why they kept the discovery a secret for nearly 2 years. How strong is the government's criminal case against him?
They really don't have a strong case. They pretend to have a case because they have, of course, to justify the seizure of the whole collection.
Right now, the collection is in the hands of a task force which is examining each work for evidence of looting. Ingrid Berggren-Merkel heads up the task force. Uwe Hartmann is the chief researcher. He says even as Germany was collapsing in 1945, the Nazis were dutifully recording the art thefts. Why did they keep these records of the evidence of their own crimes?
You mustn't throw public documents away. That's what they learned. That's what they did.
That's the German Gründlichkeit. It's his duty.
Yeah. They weren't allowed
until
to.
Until the last day.
The task force is initially examining 590 works as potentially looted from Jews, starting with this Matisse, which was looted from Jewish art dealer Paul Rosenberg in 1941. Beyond the minutiae of legality, there's a larger question, and that's the moral question.
80 years after Hitler took over, 75 years after the synagogues burned in Germany, yes, we know. That's the moral obligation, and we take it seriously, very seriously. On the other side, there are the laws.
So you're not making judgments?
No, we are not a court. We can't, we mustn't.
But you could still recommend?
Mr. Gurlitt told me when I talked to him, said what's been taken away, what's had been robbed, was his words, has to be given back.
Cornelius Gurlitt, who's recovering from a heart operation, says the collection is rightfully his and that his father did nothing wrong. But he says he is willing to negotiate. What a lot of people might wonder about is there's nothing to negotiate here. These paintings either belong to German museums and should go back to the German museums, or to Jews who owned collections and were forced to sell them.
Mr. Gurlitt is absolutely willing to find fair solutions. But what we need, of course, is clear evidence, because we have some letters addressed to Mr. Gurlitt saying, look, my grandma had a specific painting 70 years ago in her living room. No evidence, nothing.
As for Martha Henriksen, she's filed a claim with the task force, but has little confidence she'll ever see her grandfather's drawing.
Quite honestly, I don't believe in my lifetime, because I think this is going to be a long, long battle.
Cornelius Gurlitt is close to an agreement with the German authorities. He's agreed to give up paintings proven to be stolen and will retain the rest.
In the mail this week, viewers commented on Steve Croft's story about writer Michael Lewis, who says the stock market is rigged to benefit a group of high-speed traders who have made billions of dollars exploiting computerized trading. Why is this any different from wire fraud or wire tapping or insider trading? The culprits are acting on insider information. If we know who the high-volume traders are, why is no one doing anything to put a stop to this bad behavior?
Well, this past week, the FBI confirmed it is looking into the practice. I'm Scott Pelley. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes. Tomorrow, be sure to watch CBS This Morning, and I'll see you on the CBS Evening News.